I've been really excited to come to the speaker meeting this morning because I've really been looking forward all week to hearing Miss Sharon tell her story. So if y'all would please help me welcome Miss Sharon.
Miss Sharon, I love that. Thank you, ma'am. Thanks, Holly.
Good morning. My name is Sharon Crane. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Holly. That's very sweet. Miss Sharon, I think I'll take that home with me to California. You think it'll fly? You should see her. She's really tiny, but she's got these big red heels on so she could reach the microphone. I've heard things about her. Good things. So thank you, Holly, for that introduction. And thank you for inviting me, Billy and Kristen. And I love your theme, enthusiasm and gratitude in action, because that, I don't know, that says it all about my life. Aloha Bob and Billy and Pick Burns and I up at the airport, and we got to visit on the way back, and never a dull moment, and you know, four alcoholics in a car, and it's nice to get caught up with everybody and learn something new. Something Bobby said to me, I used on one of my babies this morning. She thought it was brilliant, you know. That's the way we are. And Camille, to see her again. We've corresponded for years since I first met. My Christmas list gets bigger every time I go to an Alcoholics Anonymous convention. And you know, I'll go home Monday and my boss will say, well, how was your day off? How was your weekend? I'll just say, it was fine, thanks. How was yours? Did you see a movie? I just always throw it right back at them because they don't know. I'm a worker among workers. And, you know, I just, well, I met, you know, 800 new friends and I got to buy more stamps for the Christmas cards and, you know, boy, I had a great time. How was your weekend? You know, he'd just look at me like I'm, like I told one of those jokes, you know. You know how we are. You're quiet for a long time at the office and then you tell a joke that we all laugh at, but it just kind of falls flat on the floor. And they just look at you like, wow, we're glad you didn't talk to us for 2 years because you're very strange. And Candace, I love Candace, my sister. I think we look alike the older we get. And we both have the same sponsor, so we watch out for each other. It's a good thing. And you know, Bob and Linda are my family's friend and my friend, and we've been through a lot together. I just love you guys so much. So it really means a lot you call my husband every week. Speaking of my husband, he sends his best, and that's me. So I'm here, and I like what Mike was talking about. You know, I started drinking when I was young. I was in Iowa. It was my first resentment. But I used to, my mother and father would drop me off at in Swisher, Iowa. It was nothing but a couple of bars and a dance place. So they would drop me off because I liked to dance. And they would pick me up later in the evening, and I would, like, kind of lay in the back of the car, and I'd be passing out. But they just thought I was tired from dancing because there's no alcoholism in my family except me so far. But I would dance close to those boys from Iowa City because somebody in the car had bourbon. And I would, you know, if you didn't smell like bourbon, I'd go to the next guy. You know, and so every time the Righteous Brothers, they put that slow song on, I'd be out there. You know, I didn't care. I'd ask them to dance with me because I had to get to the bourbon in the car in the parking lot. And I think I was 14 manipulating all this. So I loved drinking alcohol. I loved it from the very beginning. It allowed me to not care that I was from the mothership and couldn't find my people. And it just made me not care. And it made me fit in and made me relax. It did something for me that I thought it did for everybody, and come to find out it didn't. I recently went home for a class reunion from high school, and the first thing about five girls said to me, every time I would run into somebody, say, hi, how are you? And they would not even say, hi, how are you back? It was, do you remember the time we got in all that trouble? And, you know, we rolled the car. Or do you remember that time that we got stuck in Des Moines and my mother had to come get us because we were chasing those boys? Or do you remember the time that we slid out on that country road chasing those boys? It was like, yeah, it's nice to see you too. I mean, everybody had something in their story to tell me. And it was all around drinking. And I was the main ingredient in every single one of those stories. So they're kind of glad to see me sober. I went back for one at 5 years, and it wasn't quite the same. I was having some truth serum in me, some good acid, and being very, very drunk, trying to play volleyball. And my long hair kept getting stuck in the net, and it was... So they were glad to see me looking a little bit better at my last class reunion. So everybody that I hung out with and had a good time with, I just thought we were just having a good time and we're going to go off in life and do our thing. And I have three other siblings, and they all went off in life and did their thing. They had no path of destruction to follow. They couldn't see it, and I saw it, and I wanted to go there. I know that Alcoholics Anonymous has been around for a long time, longer than I'm old, but I think of my grandparents, and maybe somewhere in there, one of my great uncles, maybe they would have needed Alcoholics Anonymous, and it wasn't here for them. And we are the lucky ones. We are the ones that can pick up the phone and find a meeting anywhere. I can find my people anywhere. You can drop me off in a foreign country, and as soon as I get to a meeting, I'm like, fine. I'm part of the country. I'm part of the world again. Alcoholics Anonymous, when I sit my fanny in a seat here, works for me, and I am so grateful I know that. So I try to keep gratitude in my day. No matter what, I start my day with asking for sobriety that day and what I can do. And enthusiasm is something that I love. I want to be around enthusiastic people. I want to be around positive people. I love that, and we have a lot of it here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it is life itself. And it takes on a life of itself. If you are a happy, enthusiastic person, I've seen people go through all kinds of things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they have that love and that joy in their heart for their sobriety no matter what they go through. And those are the people that are my heroes. I'm really grateful we come together and we see each other's happy times and we share the sad times, and we do it together. We're all in the big boat, like from the ship liner, and I don't want to ever forget that I made it off the Titanic, because if I crawl back on that Titanic, I know where it goes. I've watched people go there. So Alcoholics Anonymous is the number one thing in my life. No matter what else happens, I have to be sober or there is no life. And my mother sleeps at night because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to you for that, just for that alone. And if I think that there's any chance for me to drink again, I have to break through a lot of people that love me and care about me, and people that I care about and love, and just that my mother sleeps at night. If I think my sobriety is about me, it's not. And the Al-Anons have said that when you're newly sober, there's 10 people that are exhaling. So if you're newly sober and you think it's about you, you're supposed to, but it's not. It's about right now those 10 people who can maybe enjoy a dinner out and not worry about the phone ringing, or that you're going to steal the money or the TV from home, or that they're not going to get a phone call, you're from jail. They can sleep at night because they know that you're safe in Alcoholics Anonymous, that there are 10 people that have been loving you, praying for you, caring for you, hoping at some point, and caring can mean letting go, that you will get to Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're here, you're one of the lucky ones. It's like fly fishing. We don't catch a lot. We don't snag a lot in the stream of alcoholism. But every once in a while, we snag one, and everybody gets excited. I don't know if you've ever watched fly fishing. It can be very boring until I get something, and then everybody's all excited. And it's kind of how we are here with newcomers. And I hope I keep that love and that zest and that enthusiasm for what I have here deep in my heart and in my actions. Because I like being part of the force for good. I like being useful. All I was ever looking for was just allow me to be useful somewhere. I knew there was something I was supposed to do. I didn't know it was to drink myself almost to death so I could come to Alcoholics Anonymous and share every piece of experience, strength, and hope I have, and hope to have somebody else link up and pull them along in the chain of sobriety. I had no idea. If you would have told me the first day I got sober, I'd be here. What is it, Robert? He's not 34 yet. Monday, if you make it, newcomer. 34 years and about 2 months, actually, 1 month and 27 days. If you would have told me I'd be here that long, I'd say, oh, come on. You're talking about my evil twin. That's not me. But it's a day at a time. And today, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I do basically, I'm going to pick up where Bob left off last night. He read 84 and 85, and it says, "It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities." And so today I'm trying to do that. But I drank, and I loved drinking, and I loved the places it took me in. It was instant courage, and I loved vodka. I loved Canadian Club. I loved bourbon. I loved Everclear. I loved blackberry brandy. I liked whatever there was, whatever I could water down, whatever I could steal. I had fake IDs, and once I was in the bars, that was a whole new scene. Loved the bars. Loved everything about the bars. You know, even to this day, if we're at a restaurant, and I got to just kind of walk by and just look at the bar a minute. Now they have these big drinks that are called, like, apple martinis and things, and it's like they're putting fruit in their martinis. I just could hardly handle it. But I respect alcohol. I respect it, and I keep myself in the rooms. I have not had to fight a craving for years, and I know people that have, and it's a hard thing. That was removed from me when my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it came back once, but I am very, very lucky to be ensconced and deeply seated in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, my drinking took me through college. It was the 60s. It wasn't just say no, it was just say thanks. We had a lot of fun. We took a lot of stuff. I like to be up and going. I never understood anybody face down going, "Let's party," you know. And so I was let's get up and let's stay up all night and let's, you know, drive across the country in 2 days and did all that. I was a busy alcoholic. And my mother was always going, "Okay, where are you now?" You know. My sister kept my address going because I kept in touch with my older sister. She would send me plane tickets. So where I was, she would know where I was, and she said she stopped writing my name in pen and my address because she kept putting tape over it and writing a new address, and tape over it writing a new address. Her address book would not close on my name anymore, so she started writing me in pencil. So I was a little resentful when I heard that in sobriety, but I let it go. So I was kind of in pencil in my family's life, and you know, I had a lot of talent, and I let alcohol, it was alcohol or talent. I want my alcohol. It was alcohol or dignity. I want my alcohol. You know, and I don't think any point in my life was it that line was being crossed or the bartender would say to me, "You know, here's your dignity. This is the end, the last piece of your dignity here. Laying on the bar tonight. Do you want this drink or do you want dignity?" I'd say, "No choice. Give me my Jose Cuervo nice and neat to the top of a double rock glass, no salt, no lime, and back it up and buy him one too. I don't care if he's married. Shut up. I don't want any bartender philosophy. I don't care about my dignity. I don't care that I used to be able to paint. I don't care that that got given to alcohol. I'm still afraid of color on a canvas. I don't know when that will come back. I don't care about my family. My dad doesn't understand me. I'm the middle daughter, and we went head to head. My dad and I couldn't sit at a table and have breakfast together. I broke my father's heart. He sent me to a priest, psychiatrist. He tried to help me, family doctor. I don't talk to the psychiatrist. The family doctor puts me on Valium, and the priest and I get drunk together. So, you know, we will find a way." And my father and I had one more fight, and he knew too much about what was going on in my life, things that fathers don't need to know about their daughters, and I would tell him, just because I wanted him to hurt like I did, and I did. My dad hurt, and all he could do was set his jaw and look away. All he could do was, you know, not catch my eye, because I would say, "What?" I'm defiant, and I'm angry, and I go, "What?" And it would start again. And on a couple of my stops home, my mother said, "Well, you can stay here, but just please stay out of your father's way, because you break his heart. And please don't take any drugs in this house." And so I drank, and I went in those local taverns in my little town in Mount Vernon, Iowa, and there were three taverns, and I would rotate the taverns on the corner of that one red light so nobody knew I was drinking every night. And it's a small town, and, you know, people follow you around, and I was in there judging all the drunks in there every night. Look at you in here every night, Billy Lang. I knew you'd be in here every night. You were a drinker in high school, and I'm in there drinking with him, and I was 21, and my gallbladder wasn't working. I had lived in New York City, worked for an ad agency. I had dropped out of college. I couldn't paint anymore. I couldn't go to art school. I came to California. I was with a commune. They asked me to leave because I drank their bong wine. They didn't drink. And I went back to Colorado, where I had first met Bob Dylan and traveled with him, or I think it was Bob Dylan, not sure. He was very spiritual, 16-4, when he had some orange sunshine, a little purple Osley, and a lot of wine. And it was Bob Dylan. And so I'm home again. I'm 21. My gallbladder doesn't work. Nobody knows what's wrong with me. I'm very, very sick, very sick. And I live upstairs, and I stay out of my dad's way, and my dog got killed on the road. My puppy that they gave me out west when I left the commune, they said, here, and take this dog, too. We don't like it either. And you know, I had all these animals that would bite the dust. You know, you're drunk, and they'd run out in the street, or they try to save you because you're fighting with somebody, and they get nailed by a car. And I had a cat that I brought back from New York City and in Iowa, and it went and lived with a neighbor later because, you know, it just was like, I'm getting away from you. I went and saw it when I was 5 years sober. It was still alive, and it saw me, and it went, oh, man, and it ran away. So I am constantly making amends to the animal kingdom, constantly. When I was newly sober and I had an apartment and I couldn't have a dog, I'd be driving down like a little street after a late night meeting with I just took a newcomer home, I'm feeling really good, and it's a little street and you can only have, one car go, and there's a dog sitting in the middle like this. I'm not going anywhere until you take me home. You know, I try to move it, get around it, and it was like, ugh, get in. And, I would take them and get them flea dipped and, worked on and then find them homes. And there'd be stray dogs that would come to, places of business, and I'd have to find them homes. And I found a lot of dogs' homes until I finally got to have a dog in my life who is so happy every time she sees me. I think of that, if you don't think there's God, get a dog, which is God spelled backwards, and go to the mailbox. And then come back, and they're all happy and wagging, like they haven't seen you in years, And that's the way I think my God is with me. He's just so, so happy to see me, even if I just go away for a little bit. You're home. And, and I have cats, rescue cats, and I've had them over the years, and I love my cats. And I have this one big rescue cat that's huge, and if you come to my house, you'll never see him. Oh, my God, somebody new, under the couch. But when I feed this cat in the morning, you would think it had never been fed for like 2 weeks. It's like all around my legs, and he won't shut up, and he's whining, and he's in my way, and he trips me up, and routine, every morning, same thing. But he's got to go through this whole little routine with me. And one day I looked down at Taz, and I went, oh, my God, that's like me and God. Oh, I want, can't you give me this? And, oh, I'll be so good. I promise. I'm hungry. I need. Whine. And I just, my animals are such a connection for me. And, they live in the now. If you need to meditate, watch an animal. They live in the now. So I've been able to make amends to the animal kingdom and continue to do so. Some of the people along the way, my friend Michael was shot and killed, Mardi Gras Day, I was living in New Orleans. How do you make amends for that? I was in a blackout and the last person to talk to him. There's a lot of things in my life I look back on, and I never knew I was going to be telling people that. Sharing my experience, Strength and Hope, being in jail in the South. I had joined the carnival after an organic farm, that's a long story, in Wisconsin, where it was cold. My only friend was Clarence the farmer. By this time, all the organic people didn't want to drink with me either, because I'd kick their banjos and make fun of their Pete Seeger records and, turn into like big old truck driver mouth and hiss at them and drink my wine, and they go, can't you just smoke these? And I go, no, it makes me thirsty. And they'd all look at me like I'm crazy and go off to bed, and me and the dog and the cat would have a great time. Well, they finally left to go do primal therapy. I said goodbye. And I got drunk and screamed at the sheep for about half a day. That was my primal. And my friend Clarence the farmer was my only bud, and he'd bring the wild turkey at night. And he'd come on his tractor in Wisconsin because his license had been pulled for too many DUIs. So he was on the tractor, and he would go to town and get the booze, and then he would come and visit me at night. And I'm the organic chick growing my crop. So my crop was good, and I had it with me with the carnival, and joining the carnival is a whole big story, but I did. I was a shooting gallery girl, and I got out of Wisconsin. That was the point. And I ended up in jail in Bogalusa, Louisiana, where grits morning, noon, and night. And I was detoxing in there and having DTs. I had no idea what was going on. And I was pretty crazy. So they came in at night and took their pick, but they left me alone, because I had cut myself, because they're coming to get me. And, you know, they were, but they left me alone because I was really out of it. I didn't shower because that was scary, too. And after being in there about a week, they took me in cuffs to this building and threw me in this room, and there sat my father. And my dad got on a plane in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, connected in O'Hare, brought his checkbook, landed in New Orleans, rented a car, tried to come find and get daughter number two out of trouble. And I hope you have a day that you remember, that when you think, oh, my alcohol doesn't, I used to say to my mom, come on, Mom, I'm not hurting anyone but me, so just stand back and watch me die. Leave me alone. And if you think that, I hope you have a day you can think back on and remember the pain of the day where you evaporated as a human being, the day the spirit ran out of you. And it was that day when I walked in, and he had hired a lawyer, and there I am, his daughter that used to play the accordion and the saxophone and the piano and drew pictures and paintings that were hanging in some of the restaurants in our small hometown and in my parents' house, who now is disheveled and crazy and cut up and handcuffed and in a big jackpot, a felony, in Bogalusa, Louisiana. And my dad sat in the chair, and I sat next to him, and we didn't look at each other. We hadn't been eye to eye in a long time. And I hope I remember how I felt that day, because if I think it's about me, it's not. And I went back to jail. I took my dad's money, and finally they let me go. And I found New Orleans, and that was the end of my drinking. I bartended, I danced, I lived in the quarter, I didn't go out if the sun was up. My favorite bar was the Bastille, because we painted black on the windows, so nothing snuck in. And it was cold, and I got 86 from there for dancing on the bar and getting my hair caught in the ceiling fan. And I was in a blackout. I had a little hair missing the next morning. I thought it was a good night, you know. My car was on the street. It wasn't somewhere else. That was a good night when you could find your car in the French Quarter, I'll tell you. We went back to the International Convention, and we were walking the Alcoholics Anonymous, 5 years sober, 1980 in New Orleans, believe it or not. And we were walking around the quarter, and I saw somebody like leap and lay on the hood of their car and sob because they had found their car. And I remember those moments, you know, because all the streets look the same, and when you park it, and then, you know, then they tow it, and then you know, you got your friend, the assistant chief of police. Thank God you have your friend, the assistant chief of police, who you call and go, is it in an impound? Can you get it out, John? Yeah, we'll go on a date tonight. Okay, you know. And he was a kind of a wild guy, but he was fun to have around. And we'd get the car out, you know. But that was a good night with a piece of hair missing and the ceiling, I guess. And they 86 me, not for that, not for the ceiling fan, but that I had gotten thrown into the bar and I had broken, like, the high-end stuff, you know. The Johnny Walkers, the Bacardis, not the well whiskey. And the owner was mad at me because I broke his good stuff. So I was 86. And that broke my heart. It was my place to drink was the Bastille. And I was tending bar, and you could come to my bar and you could have a tab. But at the end of my drinking, my New Orleans drunk friends didn't want to drink with me anymore, because I was sad and sorry and maudlin and, you know, I'd just sob on you, or I'd punch you. You never knew. I'd stand by the wall, catatonic. You just never knew how I was going to be. And my New Orleans drunken buddies, because I can call them that, they're either dead from alcoholism or they're sober, didn't want to drink with me, but they came to my last bar that I got fired from for having a bad attitude. which was you could smell the bathroom when you walked in the front door. It had some Spanish name I could never pronounce. I was supposed to dance with the guys for a dollar. They'd buy me a drink, they'd have a drink, and I'd have to go give them a dollar dance. And I didn't like where they put their hands, and I would, you know, be mean to them, and, you know, then they would tell the owner, and I would say, well, screw you, and he'd say, well, you're out of here, and I don't need you anyway, and I give him my one-finger peace sign, and that was my last job. I couldn't get hired anywhere after that. I was a bad drunk, and I, 1975, I told you my friend Michael was shot and killed. My parents had seen me living in the French Quarter with a carny guy with his pet skunk. We had a pet snake. We had my dog. Tar paper roof apartment, filth everywhere, dishes not done, roaches everywhere. My mom came in with tears in her eyes, and my father wouldn't come in. He sat at the, stood by the door with his set jaw. I could see him outside the screen with his set jaw, and, you know, they kind of let me go that day. And everything inside of me wanted to crawl in the back seat and just go back to Iowa and let's start over. Please let's start over. But I knew nothing would change, and I didn't know alcoholism. I had built my life around alcohol. I'm not trying to have a regular job or a regular life anymore. I'm building my life so I can drink. That's why I love the French Quarter, and that's why I love bartending. I had a couple of out-of-towns, like in St. Louis, I got fired from the Marriott Hotel for drinking on the job. And when I was unemployable in 1975, I hit the West Coast after being on the East for a while. I was running after my friend was killed. I was on the run, and I couldn't stand myself, and the alcohol wasn't working, and I knew I couldn't call home. I knew I couldn't go home. Home was over, and I just was on the run. I was on my way to Hawaii, and I landed at Barney's Beanery in Southern California, where I first saw the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in that bar. It's a West Hollywood bar. A lot of alcoholics have kind of made their way through that bar. It's now a tourist spot. Ugh, I don't understand it. But my son, I was actually looking at one of his credit card bills a few years ago, and it said Barney's Beanery. I said, what were you doing there? And he said, well, somebody was in from out of town, and they wanted to see it, and so we went and ate. You went and ate at Barney's? Okay. Just was very odd. But I saw the big book on a bar. It was a girl named Chris, and she was so drunk that she didn't drive to her meeting. They called a cab and took away her keys. She was going to A&A to have, I guess, a court card signed. She had to go get this thing signed. She had the big book under her arm. She barely could fit out the door. She was just falling down. And she poured in the cab, and we gave her a toast as she went out the door. Good for you, Chris. Go to A&A. And we all had a toast, and I had never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous before that moment, ever. And that was about April, and I got sober in August of that year, and she was going to be my Eskimo to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. After being on the run and not making it to Hawaii and not being able to work and being asked to leave as a cocktail waitress after about 1 hour, they said, I stood in the middle of the dance floor. I couldn't remember where the drinks went. I was so out of it. I was sick, and I had bloated, and very toxic, and I had had my gallbladder removed, and I had pancreatitis a lot. I was pretty ill, and they were out there a lot. They were going to get me. You know who they are. And they were there. When the sun was up, I had to wait for the sun to go down to crawl out of wherever I was staying. And sometimes I slept in hallways. I don't remember much of that. And I sent a letter back to one of my friends in New Orleans, Robin. She gave it to me a few years later. I had written her a poem about a bar, and I had told her how wonderful it was in sunny Southern California, and I was dying. I didn't have a home address, and it was all a lie. My life was a lie. And she gave me back that letter, and it's really one of the most precious things I have in my big book at home, because I remember where I was when I wrote that letter, and I was becoming a couple of embers of life at that time. That was about all that was left in me. And the joy of Robin in my life is that I get to sponsor her today. She came to AA about 5 years after me. And another girl named Denny, one of my old roommates, who didn't recognize me at the International Convention in New Orleans, did not recognize me. You had cleaned me up so much. is sober also in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we are the three musketeers that made it out of there. And we get together every once in a while and we celebrate our sobriety. It's amazing. We talk about, we sit around, have dinner. A lot of my girls like to come when we're all together because they hear stories, you know. They hear things that I don't tell them. And the last one was that before or after the midget? That was the... a moment I don't remember. So that became the theme of the weekend. But I am so grateful that I get a chance to give back and sponsor people, because I have been given so much, it just overflows in me. So I have no choice. And so I was on a bar stool in Barney's and went out to Palm Springs on a motorcycle because I like Harleys and I like instant gratification. I like the sound of them. I like the taste of tequila. I don't want to sit around and wait for long-term comfort. I want it now. So I'm on a Harley. I've got my tequila. I'm my red dashiki, my Panama hat, my backpack on with my book Be Here Now in there, which I knew nothing about. But I carried that book with me for years. And we went out to some club and they left me, and I said, hey, I thought we were going to party. And they said, nah, we just need a little extra weight on the back of the, you know, the bike because it's windy. It was windy going through the desert. So thanks. And they left. I was just dead weight on the back of a bike to them. And I met some new people in a blackout to have a good time with. And I end up in a situation where it's not a DT. It's not something that's happening in my, you know, my detoxing from alcohol. I used to have kind of violent DTs with people choking me and that kind of thing, but start awake. But this was really happening, and they had taken me somewhere and broke my jaw in three places and broke my nose and, you know, drug me around for a while. And I remember realizing this was really happening to me, and I just stopped screaming. I didn't fight anymore. I'm a fighter. I think we're all survivors. We are all survivors. We are survivors, and I was a fighter, and that fight had left me. And this thing had to go to court, and I didn't really remember all that until they ended up catching these people. I was a victim of violent crime. It was July 27th, 1975. I landed in hospital in Palm Springs. They put my jaw back together. I was in intensive care for a week. Let's just say they didn't know I was a Caucasian when they found me. I had so many bumps, bruises, scrapes, and blood on me. And I was very lucky to just have gotten away with nose and jaw broken. And it went to court, and I was sober. And I had this wired jaw, so I couldn't talk very well. And the man that stood on the stand said that he had heard somebody screaming, and he didn't know what to do. And then he heard somebody screaming again, and then it just stopped. And when he said that, I remember the moment that I surrendered. I gave up. I just stopped. I said, who the hell cares anyway? My life wasn't worth spit. And that was the moment I had to reach for me to be able to accept the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And that happened on August 20th, 1975. I was living above a liquor store, drinking red wine through the wires on the mouth where the tooth had been kicked out, because I'm a drinker. But there was no more, God, let's go start over in, you know, Seattle, or let's go start over in Honolulu. There was no more excitement in alcohol. There was no more answer in alcohol. I was drinking because I'm a drinker. So I'm drinking cheap red wine with a guy that said I could stay there. He'd buy me that, go off to work, and I would sit there all day long and just drink wine. And that morning, he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, it's August 20th, he said, you have to leave, you're depressing me. I was like, oh man, I had nowhere to go, nowhere to go. And I didn't have a plan that day. You know, it was my day. If I would, maybe the next day I would have had a plan, but that day I was out of plan. And I called my mother, because you got to call mom when you have nowhere to go. Because mom would maybe do something for me to help me out. And my mom had gotten a call from that hospital in Palm Springs that what had happened to her daughter, and they did not tell her what hospital I was in. So for two nights, my mother did not sleep, wondering where I was. And my sister in New York and my mother in Iowa called every hospital in California till they found me. And she has never been to Al-Anon, but she has an amazing sense of God in her life. And what she said to me was, "Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Go to the Salvation Army." And right there, I hung on the balance of whether I was going to make the next call. If she would have said, "I'll send you $20 and just don't call home anymore, you break our heart," she would have sent $20, you'd have another speaker. I know that. Because I would have waited for it and I would have done something with that $20. And then I called my friend that was sitting there, her phone number, Chris, not realizing she was the girl in the bar with the big book getting her court card signed, not realizing any of that. But her number was there because she was dating the guy that I was staying with that let me stay with him because I had nowhere to go. And I called her, and she recognized alcoholism. She knew me. She knew what happened. And she said, "Sharon, I can't help you, but call Suzanne. And I don't call strangers." And the reason she couldn't help me was she wasn't sober that day. So she knew to get me to a sober person of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody's mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody's mentioned alcoholic. They just said, "Call this person." And I called a stranger, which I don't do, and asked for help. And this woman, Suzanne, and Cubby got on the phone. And I had this wired up John. You know, I can't hardly talk. First 3 months in AA, I'm wired up. It's a blessing. I had to learn to listen, you know. They used to say, "Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth." Well, they didn't have to say any of that to me. They would just look at me and go, "Look at, maybe she'll make it. Look at her. She looks surrendered." Or people would come by and talk to me constantly and incessantly, and because I couldn't talk back. And it was just like, "Oh, I don't want to know all this about you." You know, it was exhausting. But I was so tired when I got to you. I was so tired. And I called Suzanne, and Suzanne knew instantly where I was because it was a liquor store that sold out the back after hours. Every alcoholic knew the Duck Pond Liquor Store in West Los Angeles. They delivered. They took bad checks. So she could understand from my broken jaw where I was. She told me to put down my drink and put down my joint, and I thought, how does she know I have both? Piqued my interest. And she told me where to go sit. She knew the stairs, where to go and where to sit. And I waited for someone to come get me. I don't know where I'm going, but the beauty is I did it. I listened to her. She got my interest, and she said, "Go sit on the stairs at the bottom by the front door of the liquor store." And I did. And this car pulled up with two beautiful California girls in it. It was a bright yellow Volkswagen, which was hard to look at because it was so bright. You know, I'm just not a day girl at all now in my life at this point. And they got out with bright teeth and shiny hair. Shiny. Everything was shiny. It was hard to look at. I just did not look at them. And they're walking towards me, and I'm thinking, no, I don't like you. I am not going anywhere with you. You're not my type. And they picked me up by my shoulders and put me in the back of the Volkswagen where I couldn't get out. And we came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at every red light, the driver would turn around and tell me parts of her story. I didn't know what she was doing. And when she wasn't talking, the other one would turn around and tell me parts of her story. And I just thought, God, they talk a lot about themselves. When are they going to ask me about me? I carried a newspaper clipping in my jeans pocket for months until it disintegrated from the Palm Springs paper about the unemployed bartender that was victimized on July 27th. I carried that in my pocket thinking somebody will say, "Oh my God, what happened to you?" And nobody did. They just would go, "Well, you look ready." And we came to this meeting. I don't know where I am still. It's a church. I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, I'm a fallen away Catholic. They're going to ask me for my confession, or I'm going to have to, you know, sit in the kitchen until I clean up and they'll let me come sit with the congregation. I just felt so small and weak and tired. And the secretary at the door was dressed in a suit and tie, and he stuck his hand out to me and he said, "Welcome." I wasn't ready for welcome. I was ready for, "Please go sit in the kitchen until you can look nicer." And they sat me in a meeting. I don't remember much. My friend Beverly raised my hand. She tells me to this day. Beverly and Joe A. were there, and they kind of surrounded me. And a man named Maurice Zhao came up at the end of the meeting, Maurice Zalatau, and gave me a big book. And I went, oh, because I still don't know where I am. I just remember a man at the podium saying he waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. I went, oh, spaceship people. It's kind of where I was. And I thought, good, my people. Maybe I found my spaceship people. And then this guy Maurice came up and gave me this big book, and he started talking about payment terms, and I'm starting to, you know, hallucinate a little bit. So I gave him a quarter just to get him out of my face, and he was so happy. He went over and wrote it down, and I guess, you know, newcomer Sharon, you know, 25 cents, and he came back and he gave me the big book, and he wrote my name, my sobriety date, and where I was in pencil. And I still have his handwriting on my very first big book. And I paid him for that big book one quarter at a time. And he came to my watch when I turned 1 year sober. We have something called a watch. We watch you turn one. We don't let you out of the booth. If you go to the bathroom, you go with him. You know, we're going to make you turn one tonight. There's no getting away. So at my watch, when I turned 1 year sober, Maurice showed up. He said, I knew you'd make it. You were the only newcomer that year that paid me back for that big book one quarter at a time. And I remember I didn't want to owe you guys anything because I'm just here for a little while and then I'm off again because I can't stay anywhere very long. I don't know how to stay somewhere. I'm a runner. You know, I drank when I had a feeling, a good feeling or a bad feeling. I drank to move. I drank for everything in my life. I drank to have boyfriends. I drank to have girlfriends. I drank for everything. And now I'm sober. There's nothing in me and I am really tired. I am tired, so I was happy to have floors to sleep on. I was happy they moved me out of that liquor store. I was happy to have a borrowed sleeping bag. I was happy that my mother sent me a blender so I could eat with this broken jaw. I was happy to just have a place to be safe. I felt safe in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't felt safe in a long time. I hadn't exhaled in a long time. And it was very rare that I still was, but I was maybe a little bit sleeping. I would read that big book at night. I got a sponsor because they wouldn't shut up about it. You know, sponsor, you're going to get drunk. You know, sponsor, you're going to get drunk. And I didn't like this guy that I was the dishwasher. He was the dryer. He had more time than me. And I don't talk anyway still, so they just put me in the dishes. We had real cups at Echo Park and ashtrays. And, you know, sometimes I would wash the ashtrays with the cups just to be a little bit rebellious, but I'd rinse good, and then Mike dried, and he left something on it, you know, I'd snarl at him, and you better get sponsored, you're going to get drunk. I just thought, shut up, but I got a sponsor to shut him up, and Janet was my sponsor for almost 5 years, and she was a crazy person that worked really hard at staying in sanity and in sobriety, and I didn't know that about her. So she made me work really hard. I had to do her program. There was no watering down there, boy. She had me doing everything. And I was so grateful. She gave me good training and smart feet. She walked up to me one night and she said, you got that runner look in your eyes. You're getting ready to go, aren't you? I was like, how does she know? You know, we forget they've been there, you know. So she said, hang on to the seat. So I had to hang on to the seat. She said, just grip the seat and don't run. Don't run. So, okay, I gripped the seat. And she walked up to me a couple days later. She said, oh, you're not gripping the seat anymore. You just worked step two. I'm your new higher power. You know, she said that and walked away with her little clip-clop heels, her pink hot pants, her purple fingernails, and maybe a yellow bow in her hair. She was little, but I could always find her. She was bright. And she'd laugh like a duck. Quack, quack, quack. I was like, oh, God. I'd be in a room, and she wasn't at the meeting. I know she was out dating him, you know, and she won't give me the night off to watch the Country and Western Music Awards. That was my first call. Can I have the night off to watch it? I don't even know about the Country and Western Music Awards, nor did I even, unless I was drinking gin. I didn't even like country music because I could cry with gin. I called her, can I then have to watch the Country Western Music Award? She said no and hung up the phone. And then I'm at the meeting. I bet she's doing that with him. I'm sitting in the front row and I'm mad. I'm just so mad. I thought, I'm here. Where's she? And then in the back of the room, main speaker's talking. I hear quack, 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 quack. And I felt safe again. I felt safe again. Janet made me feel safe. And she was good for me. She kept it very simple. She, like I said, she gave me smart feet. My feet are still smart. I love my feet. They're pedicured, manicured. They're my friends. They get me to meetings. They get me to work. They get me where I got to go when everything inside of my head says they don't understand. They're going to fire me today. Nobody liked me anyway. When my head talks to me, my feet do the right thing. I have smart feet. My feet are in action. I have enthusiastic and grateful feet, even when my head isn't sometimes. So if you're new, take care of your feet. Your head will be out to get you. Put your brain in the trunk of a car for about a year. And if you don't have a car, put it in your sponsor's trunk. If you don't have a sponsor, get a sponsor with a car so you can put your brain in the trunk for about a year. Because we are not good thinkers when we're new. We have a lot of plans when we're new. Now, one of mine was leaving again. And a man named Chuck Nesbo, who was a great guy in our group, walked up to me one night and he said, "What are you doing?" And he didn't wait because I still had a wired jaw. He looked at my little list, and my little list said things like 8 rides from June Ann to the meeting, $20 from Susie, you know, Mary gave me some clothes, you know, sleeping bag, must return, because I was keeping a list. Because I'm going to pay you back before I leave. I don't want you saying something about me because you're nice people. I liked you. And he said, "Put that list away." And I thought, what is he talking about? He said, "Sharon, one day you're going to have a car, driver's license, insurance all in the same name." How do you know that? You know? And you'll be able to give those newcomers rides. One day you're going to have a couch and a newcomer needs a place to stay and she'll be able to sleep there. You're going to hear that someone is starting a new job and you're going to be able to take the clothes from the cleaner in the cleaner bag and give them to her after the meeting. I thought, how does he know that? His wife had given me some clothes just like that when I started a job because I didn't have anything. And she gave them to me in the parking lot in nice cleaner bags. I wasn't embarrassed at a meeting that I had nothing. I thought, how does he know all this? He says, "What we want you to do, Sharon, is to stay and pay us back. And the way we want to be paid back is to pass it on. We don't care. Put that list away. Just pass it on to the next one who needs it." And that's been my life. It's opening my eyes and passing it on to the next one who needs it. I have to be awakened here to see it. At 7 years of sobriety, I stopped being the victim. And once I hung up those victim clothes, something came inside of me that I hadn't felt before. And I think it was just something called unconditional love. And it's an amazing thing because love doesn't discriminate at all. It's not a discriminator, and it's very gracious. It's very humble. And, you know, it's from the source. It has not much to do with me. I just have to keep myself cleaned out so I can love every day. You know, Chuck C. used to talk about it rains on the just and the unjust, and I had no idea what he was talking about. You know, Chuck C. used to talk a lot when I was new, just right over my head, you know. He'd repeat himself. He'd laugh a lot. And people would go, "Oh, Chuck C. speaking." And I just go, "God, I don't understand a thing he's saying." And it was so simple, I missed it, you know. And but he looked like my grandfather, so I would always go up and say thank you to him and try to talk to him a little bit. And he was always very sweet to me. But, you know, I started to get him in the end a little bit. And, you know, he talked a lot about the God within. And that's what happens here is when we work these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a spiritual awakening. As a result of these steps, enough cleaning out, enough telling of the truth, enough making amends, that somewhere inside of me there's a space that God gets to live. And every day I get to find that space. Every day it's my job to clear out my junk so I can find that space and be useful and a part of the force for good. And I feel like I don't have a choice because I've been given so much here. And I wasn't a rock at the start of it anyway at all in my sobriety. I was one of those kind of rebels. I waited tables. They wouldn't let me bartender. I had a bad attitude. I don't make much money. The Al-Anons had to teach me how to smile when I didn't feel like it. They taught me how to do that. Sally Carpenter took me aside one night and made me the big smile and said, "Go do that tonight on your night shift and see if your tips are better. Quit telling people how you are. You're bringing them down. They just want food." So I went out that night, and I thought, this is a big phony thing I'm going to do. But I smiled, and my tips were better. You know, I thought, these people are smart. And Janet, I called Janet one morning, and I had a horrible headache. I had migraines a lot. I had pancreatitis. I hung in there. I just tried to learn to meditate and pray through it, and I got through it. And I didn't have to go in the hospital. I didn't have to take anything, and it's gone away. I can't get away with not taking care of my body because it rebels. Believe me, I'd love to, but it rebels. And then I don't feel good, and then I'm not of service. So my sobriety is physical in nature also for me. And I called her that morning, and I had the migraine. I said, I'm dying. You know how we are. I'm dying. And this is it. And it was early in the morning. She hadn't had her coffee yet. Don't do that to your sponsor. Let them have their coffee and their morning time. Maybe you'll get a better answer. But I was on it, and I called her, and she said, well, you know what? If you die at work, we're going to give you a great send-off. Your parents will come. It's going to be the best funeral we've had in a long time in AA. We'll have lots of flowers. We'll say nice things about you. But if you die at home in bed, there is no funeral. And she hung the phone up on me. And I hated her. You know how that is? But it motivated me. I'm going to die at work and she'll feel bad the rest of her life. And I didn't, of course. Once I got out of myself, I was okay. In the morning, sometimes I'd literally, my hand would stick on the doorknob. I'd have to turn it so I could go out in the world. I'd take the other hand and turn it. I was afraid of flying. I was afraid of getting shot. I had all kinds of these strange fears. We finally did my inventory, and we kind of got some stuff out of the way, and we laughed, and she shared things back with me. And I dropped her off that morning, and the sun was out, coming out. And it was that sky blue pink in the morning, and I hadn't seen a sunrise in about a year, really. Usually it's a sunrise, oh God, let's go in. And something came in my head, which wasn't me. It said, oh, look at that sky, it's really beautiful, angels would live there. And I thought, oh, that's a corny, who said that? Angels would live here. And I guess what happened was there was just enough cleaned out that I had a momentary moment of grace. And that night I sat deep in my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was almost a year sober. And my friend Pat, who is 8 days less than me, came in and stole my thunder 8 days after me, cried all the time. Old-timers loved her more than me. Oh, let's go to this one. She can talk, you know. Pat had done her inventory way before me, had done her amends, and was just this prim and proper. I didn't realize her husband was dying of cancer, so she had to get through her steps quickly. I didn't know any of that. I just thought, I don't like you, and you're too, you know, too uppity for me. And she would look at me when they read chapter 5, and I know she was looking at me going, I've done my fourth step and fifth step, and I'm well into my amends. Look at you, you know. And I thought, oh, God, those 8 days I'll never drink just so I have 8 more days than her. I swear to God, she kept me here some days. And I sat in the meeting that night, and I was waiting for Pat to look over at me because I had done my fifth step 1 week before my birthday, my first birthday, so I could give her my one-fingered peace sign again. And she had heard. The word was out. Sharon did her inventory. Sharon finally read her fifth step, and she turned around and gave me a big smile. And everything just kind of melted. And the beauty of that relationship is we're both still here, and we both still take cakes in August. Together. And that's a long-term relationship. And she lost her husband a year and a half ago now, Vince. And we were all there for her. She walked through with a lot of dignity and grace. And we love Pat. He's one of my heroes. 8 days less, but one of my heroes. So I started my life, and it's just been, I got married, I met Boy Meets Girl on AA campus, and I was starting to get a sense of a higher power. We were working on convention committees, we went on panels, we did everything. We went to concerts with sober people, we had fun, we had a good time. My ex-husband was a lot of fun for a long time, and my dad walked me down the aisle, and we had an AA wedding with ham and cheese sandwiches, and day at a time put in the vows, and we sobered up a rock and roll band, so we had one guy sober, but he sobered up the singer. She's still sober today, it's a great thing, so that they could sing at our dance, and they didn't have a dance, father-daughter dance, so we did Mac the Knife. That was that's just kind of as slow as they could get, so that was my wedding song. It was a lot of fun, And at the end of the day, my dad looked at me, because somebody snapped a picture, and we were eye to eye. And my dad said to me, I remember the moment. I don't remember the eye to eye thing, but I remember that he looked at me and he said, I don't remember that eye to eye that much, but I have a photograph of it. He said, Sharon, if you think about doing what you're doing before, think twice, because you've got it made here. And my father accepted my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And part of me wanted to go, well, it's about time, Dad. You know, I mean, you've accepted that Mensa older sister forever, Miss Brainiac, little Nurse Sally, who moved to Alaska so you could go visit and have fun because you love Alaska, and then, you know, your son carrying the name, God forbid, and then there's me, the alcoholic. Well, I'm glad you finally accept my life. But I didn't, because you have taught me how to have some humility, and I looked at my father and I said, you're right, Dad. Because I had been going home trying to make living amends to my dad. The first time I made amends to my dad, voice to voice, was simple and quick. And my bags were in the trunk to go back to Los Angeles, and I better get it done because that sponsor will put me back on the plane. I knew she would. It's good to fear your sponsor a little bit. And I had told my dad what I had to tell him, and he said, I always wanted you to be happy. She said, that's your job then. You go be happy with your dad. But about 5 years, I got another sponsor, a woman named Ginny, and called her up one day, and I said, he's being mean to me, my husband. And she said, okay, it's time to make financial amends to your father. Like, do you have a checklist by the phone? What is, you know, they kind of wait for you to call. Okay, the next thing we're working on, I don't care what's going on in your life. You know, I got an abscess tooth, who cares? We're going to make amends to your father. Financial amends, how does she know about that? I didn't tell her about that. You know, I think they go to sponsor school. I'm still looking for the manual somewhere, but so I thought, this is weird, and we didn't talk about him being mean to me. I just called up my dad and said, you know, I'm at this point in my life, I got a better job, and told him what I was going to do, and he said, great, it's this much. He had gotten the big book when he went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when he came out to my wedding. He had read it. He had run a calculator tape. He looked at my dossier, and he figured it all out. And it was too quick, and he was too fast with it, and I had a new resentment. And it was he was off. He was off by a couple thousand, at least, you know. And my mother told me later on that he had run a calculator tape and put it on page 86. I think it says, most alcoholics owe money. He said, look, if I'm not home and Sharon gets to this part of the book, she might call. And here it is circled in red. So he was ready for me, and so I had a new resentment, and my sponsor laughed. And 2 days later, I called him back, and he accepted my payment terms. And so I called Jenny back. I said, oh, my God, he accepted my terms. She said, then don't be late. You're the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous your father might ever see. Do not be late. I don't care. You know, it's like Bill and Bob are watching. Don't be late. So she said, are you really willing to grow through this with your dad? She didn't say, are you willing to heal and have a nice relationship with him? Are you willing to be daddy's little girl again? She didn't say any of that, because I knew that wasn't possible. Now, we could be civil and be in the same car and go to the same hardware store and hang out a little bit, but I don't know. He still passes the phone back to mom pretty quick when we talk on Sunday nights. And are you willing to grow through this with your dad? My sponsor wanted something more that she saw I could have that I knew I couldn't, and I believed her, and so I went, what? You know, you're in a corner, you got to say, okay. She said, I want you to put a note with those checks that you're going to send your dad about your life. Tell him about your life. All right. First note was, well, I went on a jail panel. You know, little yellow piece of paper on the check. Hope you're well. Love, Sharon. And she said, did you send the note with a check on time? I'd say, yes. She asked me that for I don't know how many months. And then Father's Day rolled around, and I seemed to be able to pick out the card a little easier. I didn't have to sweat in front of the cards. Oh, God, that says too much, or that says the wrong thing, or he'll think I'm stupid, or things got a little easier between me and Dad, looking back on it. The trips home got a little easier. I did this, checking a note to my dad, checking a Hallmark card to my dad, checking a letter to my dad. One day I just poured out a letter. For 4 years and about 9 months, as best I can figure, he got that check on time and that note. And he called me up between Christmas and New Year's that year, dialed the number myself, It wasn't Mom on the phone handing it to Dad. My then husband said to me, "It's your dad." And I thought, something's happened to Mom. He never called me alone. He said, "Merry Christmas. I don't want your money anymore, but don't stop sending me your notes." That's AA. I was 10 years sober. My husband had a new wife picked out. She was new. It was painful. She was in the room. Nobody got custody. Had a year and a half old baby. It was quite the year, I must say. My sponsor smoked pot, then she drank, so I had to get a new sponsor. I landed at Clancy's door with my baby and a little Aprica stroller going, "I don't like you, I don't know if you like me, but I need help." He said, "Come in and sit down, we'll try." So now we've been trying since I was about 10 years sober, so that's 24 years. He's been my sponsor, and he's been louder than my head when I need him. He helped me walk through that year when I needed to, that painful year of divorce. He helped me see my part. I was on my way to throwing two hot cups of black coffee on them at a Saturday night meeting because they looked too happy. And they were pregnant and married in that order, and I was pissed. I was mad at all of you because you knew I was betrayed, and nobody told me. I was mad at all of you. All my babies jumped ship. I got the crazy ones with the eyes spinning, and we'd get in a car, and we'd drive to a meeting 4 hours away in Sacramento. "Where are we going?" "To a meeting. Can't we stop and pee?" "No." And I was just like, I was so intense. And two of those girls I'm still sponsoring to this day. They didn't even know how crazy I was, but I was sober and I was in the room and I was hanging on to my seat. And my feet were out and my arms were folded and my hair was spiked Madonna white one night. I went and got it all cut off and done white. Spiked it up, which meant stay away, you know. I'll hurt you. And Pat Hodges walked over my feet one night with a newcomer, and she said, "Look at Sharon, she's got 10 years. Do you want what she's got?" I'm so grateful to her for that moment. And my sponsor stopped me with the two hot cups of coffee on my way back to see him and said, "You'll walk through this with dignity and grace." And if he would have stopped there, I said, "I want revenge. I don't want dignity and grace." But he didn't, because they always take it one more step, you know. They believe in you just a little bit. And you say, "Oh, God, why do they believe in me?" He said, "So you can be an example to others." I heard him. And little did I know that a few years later, when he was going to leave her for somebody else, how they come is how they go sometimes, that she was going to say she knew she could do it because she had watched me. So whoever gets my example, I don't get to judge that. Whoever gets my love, I don't get to judge that. It rains on the just and the unjust, as Chuck said. And I just have to love, and I have to be awake, and I have to be available. And that's my job. And getting there takes work, takes maintenance, definitely. But Jill and I share cakes every year, and we've raised our sons pretty much in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they've turned out great. Our kids have turned out great. I got a little help from the nuns when my son got kicked out of the Lutheran school in kindergarten. I called Clancy, "I'm crying, I got kicked out of the school." And he said, "Take him to Sister Sheila." So I took him to Sister Sheila, and I'd sit in the back, and she'd say, we're going to go have lunch after Mass. I'll meet you in the back after Mass." And I'd sit in the back of that church, and I think, when did these Catholics start talking about peace and love? When did this come into this, the whole thing here? And I had a new pair of glasses with that. And Sister Sheila shaped my kid up, and he's a terrific human being today. He's gone to film school. Bob Sunpeter's helped him, and Linda Sunpeter has helped him. And he's a hard worker, and he's a good guy. And he looked at me the other day and said, "Everything in moderation, Mom." I thought, where did you come from? But he's a good boy, and my dad and my mom, when I went through that divorce, I called him one night, and he was a little boy. I sent him home every summer to know his father, his grandfather, and his grandmother. And my dad got killed April 19th, 10 years ago, and it was on a spring day out on his land, and He had given up farming. He was a construction man, had his own company, and the tractor went over on him, and he was gone in a second. And he was around heavy equipment his whole life. It was just his day. It was instant, and he died with his boots on, which is what my dad wanted. And my son stood up at his grandfather's wake and said some wonderful things because I had sent him home every year to them. And they had come out, and they drove me a car out because my car died, and they drove me this Ford Fairlane out with deer whistles, and nobody knew what the deer whistles were. It was fun. To beam in the ship, I'd tell everybody. And Alcoholics Anonymous healed my relationship with my dad. So much so that when it was, when he was gone, I was able to write him a letter of love and put my chip in and give it to him. And I got to play him an accordion number that day at his wake, too. He's, like I said, he was Czech, and he had a Heligonkin button accordion, and I used to play the piano accordion and the Boddicker accordion band just because my dad loved it. You know, I risked that, you know, all the boys from the night before would look at me and go, is that her? You know, because it was very corny, but I got my dad's Heligonkin accordion, and I worked all day on a song for him, and my sponsor was out of town. He was out of the country when this happened. I'm at his wake. It's raining like crazy. The whole town has turned out. My whole family's there. Everybody thinks I'm my older sister, you know, because Nancy the Mensa, I had a follower through school, and they'd call me Nancy, and I was, like, starting to get really irritated. So I went to the rectory, and I called Clancy back at the mission from Iowa. And he was back in town from South America or somewhere, and he said, I know I heard. I'm so sorry. And I said, Clancy, I want to play this accordion number, but they're calling me by my sister, and I, you know, it's like, So he stopped him, and he says, Sharon, you'll do a great job. Get up there and do a great job for your dad. I want you to really do one thing for me, though. Look around that church when you're playing, because there won't be a dry eye. But what I want you to do for me is look at those people that are sobbing, and just know they're the musicians. He brought me right back to reality, and louder than my head, and that's what I need. I need humor in my life. I've got to laugh at it. It's also funny. I married Casey 3 years ago. We went together a long time, and we moved in for a year. We got engaged, and we got married, and my son walked me down the aisle in Vegas, and it was a great day. And he'll be 27 years sober in November. I watched him come in and out, and then stay. And little did I know that someday, you never know, whatever newcomer is there, you never know. Watch the dance tonight. You know, be careful. And we have a great life, and he's a great man, and I respect and love him so much. And he's strong, and he's going through some stuff now. We're all going through it, but it's his thing, and he's got the battle of his life ahead of him. But he's showing up in AA and showing up at work and looking handsome and has a good attitude, and I've seen him transform because the love that you've given him and the love inside of him has transformed him. And it's so wonderful to sit right next to it and watch that. You know, I get it a lot watching the newcomers, the light go on the eyes, but to have it right there at home is a beautiful thing. And I love that Alcoholics Anonymous is ever-changing and ever more wonderful in my life. It never stops. We were talking about that in the car. Burns was talking about that in the car coming over, that we are so lucky to have found a program that continually makes me fall in love with it over and over again. And it's because of the new people. It's because of the old-timers. And it's because of all the people that have allowed me to link up in their life. And I need to tell you this story, and then I'm going to sit down. Thank you for listening to me. Thank you for having me. A few years ago, I didn't know this, before my dad died, he 12-stepped the town drunk in Mount Vernon, Iowa. He came to him to complain about his wife and borrow another bottle from my dad, because my dad had a business and always had a bar, which was good for me growing up, because I watered things down. And my dad said, you know what, you're an alcoholic, it's not your wife's fault, here's the book, my daughter's sober, maybe this will help you. And I was speaking at a little meeting north of town a few years ago. My dad had been gone a couple of years. And I happened to mention that because my mother had told me about this. I didn't know. And it came out of my mouth at the podium. And after the meeting, this girl came up to me, and she was kind of like, oh, my God, She said, "What's that man's name?" And I told her. She said, "That's my uncle. He's still sober." And I went home for a family reunion 2 years ago to Lisbon, Iowa, and that uncle that your dad gave the big book to, that's still sober, he 12-stepped me, and I have 2 years. So every once in a while, you get to see the ripple hit the shore. And I just was so happy I was awake for it at that moment, because I felt so much love back. I used to think freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. It was my cry. I found out that freedom is having a heart full of Alcoholics Anonymous, smart feet, people I love, people that are strong for me and that I can be strong for. Sitting in the boat with all of you and rowing, because that's what you've taught me to do. And sometimes I'm tired and you row, and sometimes you're tired and I row. But we do this together. Thanks for having me. Thank you.